We're on chapter 40. Well, let's start with 47:28, which is actually also, coincidentally, how rarely does this happen, the portion that we're reading this Shabbat, yeah. Vayechi. What's that? Is it the first time?
Think about it. You started page 1, line 1.
Well, it is the same portion, whether it's happened before or not. It must have happened before, but whether it has or not, it's certainly happening today. So Jacob lived 17 years in the land of Egypt. So the span of Jacob's life came to 147 years, okay? And when the time approached for Israel to die, very interesting that they switch his name from Jacob to Israel, you know, when he's about to die. And I think, I mean, there obviously the commentators are all over this. And the comment that makes sense to me in a sort of rabbinic sense is that this is the passing of a generation in a way that Abraham and Isaac's death was not, right? Because from now on, everything is going to be different. There isn't going to be another, I mean, it's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are the patriarchs. The patriarchal age is ending. Israel is now going to be enslaved in Egypt. It's a bigger change from Jacob to Joseph than from Abraham to Isaac. That's the idea. Is that right? It's an entirely new chapter in Israel's history. This is the prelude to the slavery, and so it's not just Jacob who's dying. It's a period of Jewish history that is dying. When I say that there's a period of history, I think that's our natural tendency to divide up both lives and also peoples. And also historical events into periods. I don't know how many of you have been following, this just occurred to me, but it was very interesting, have been followed David Brooks' columns in the New York Times. He asked people over 70 or over 75 to write in about their lives, and he collected them and went and read through them and tried to determine what characteristics made people's lives happier or less happy, how they described it. And one of the things that he said he found in the lives of people who were happy was that they divided their life into periods. It was not one continuous flow. This was the time when I did this and this, and then something new began, and I did that and that. And so they were able to sort of see their own lives as a process of self-renewal in a way that someone who had undifferentiated, you know, it's just this was all one continuous flow, was not able to do. There were other things too. It's interesting to look up. He wrote, I think, two or three columns on this, and he talked about it on Charlie Rose, who, when he's great, is great. At other times, it's just a soporific and good to watch. So you can go to sleep when they're discussing, you know, the economy of China, unless that excites you, right. I don't have a yen for that sort of thing, so sorry. So it's Israel that dies because it's an entirely different and new generation that is passing, and when he's about to die, his thought is obviously of his legacy, because he's also called Israel, since Israel, which is something that we don't normally think about, but Israel is this, ambiguous is not the right term, it's actually a multi-referential term. I'm sure there's a better word, but in other words, Israel refers both to the people and the land. And we don't normally, you know, France is not French. It's said a little bit differently, but Israel is Israel is Israel. There's the people Israel, the land of Israel, and the founder of it is named Israel too. So the tie for all this is that the person who gave birth to the people Israel, who is outside the land of Israel, is calling his child to return him to Israel, and is called Israel in this transaction, right? It's no longer called Jacob, but it's called Israel. And what he wants is to be sure that he will be buried in the land, and the reason that he wants that is because because for many people, I once heard this definition, although I don't know who coined it. Home is where your ancestors are buried. And there's something very powerful about that, right? And if you are separated from that, you feel as though you're not entirely settled, and given the chance, you will always go back to that place because that's where your ancestors are buried, right? Like people visit their parents' graves, even if they're in other cities, because that's, so if Israel gets buried in Israel, that's part of his guarantee that eventually the people will return to the land. So he calls Joseph, who's the only one empowered, obviously, to do this, since the other kids count for bubkas in Egypt. That's a biblical term. Do me this favor. Place your hand under my thigh. This is how you pledge in the Bible. The delicate way of saying this is you pledge on the generative organ. In other words, you pledge by genitals, right? That's where the, under your thigh is a... you know, that's where, right, that's where you put your hand under your thigh. As a pledge of steadfast loyalty, please do not bury me in Egypt. Now, one of the people, remember, we've talked all along the way about the people who are the pro-Joseph faction and the people who are the anti-Joseph faction, right? Was Joseph, in fact, a good guy, or was Joseph not a good guy, or was he mixed, and in what way was he mixed? So the anti-Joseph faction says that Jacob needed to make Joseph swear is not to Joseph's credit. First of all, Jacob ought to have taken it for granted that Joseph would not allow him to be buried in Egypt, unless Jacob feared that somehow Egypt had become Joseph's land, right? It's almost like, I mean, imagine somebody, you know, how many people have brought their parents out here from the East Coast, and the parents feel like, okay, you're now a Californian, but I want to be buried back in Brooklyn. So promise me. Now, you wouldn't have to promise you if you felt as though, no, at heart, you're still a Brooklynite. Of course, you're going to be buried in Brooklyn. You want me to be buried in Brooklyn. But that's not the way it works. Once you're transplanted, I mean, he saw his kids there, and presumably Joseph had all the accoutrements of an Egyptian royalty. So Jacob feels the need to make Joseph promise that he'll bring him back to Israel. What he doesn't know and can't know yet is that Joseph will exact the same promise from the people Israel. But Jacob doesn't see it that way. He says, please do not bury me in Egypt. When I lie down with my fathers, take me up from Egypt and bury me in their burial place. So this is also very interesting. He's laying down with his fathers, not literally. He doesn't say, when I die, go lay me down with my fathers. In some way, you go to your fathers as soon as you die. And then he says, when I'm laying with my fathers already, that is when I'm dead with my ancestors, then go bury me where they're buried, back in Israel. But this is the biblical term for, one of the biblical terms for dying is to be gathered to your ancestors. Which makes sense because even if you're agnostic about whatever happens to you after you die, wherever they went, you're going, right? Even if it's nowhere, you're going there too. So you are in fact gathered to your ancestors after you die. And we know, I mean, the question of what the Bible thinks happens to you after you die is a really interesting question that we're not gonna go into in detail now, but there is some sense that there is a place, whether Sheol or goes by a couple of other names, where ancestors gather. Whether they gather consciously or not consciously is not entirely clear. I mean, if you look, for example, I just said I wasn't going to talk about it, but I didn't put my hand under your thigh and swear. So I guess I'm free to go ahead as I choose. If you look, for example, in the Psalms, Lo hametim yahalleluyah, what does that mean? The dead don't praise you. Which is a pretty interesting thing for the psalmist to say. Why don't the dead praise God? You would think that the dead, if they have consciousness, they would praise God. So there are indications in the Bible that there are parts of the Bible that believe that after you die, that's it. But there are other parts of the Bible that clearly believe that after you die, you're still around, such as when Saul summons Samuel from the underworld, and Samuel comes up and says, basically, what are you bothering me for? So whatever that means, here there is that ambiguity. In one way or another, you're gathered to your fathers before you're gathered to your fathers. And here, obviously, it's when you look, it's avotai, which in theory could mean, you know, as the if you want to use the male gender to encompass both fathers and mothers, but it says avotai, like Abba, like father. Anyway, take me up from Egypt and bury me in their burial place. He replied, I will do as you have spoken. But then Jacob goes on and says, swear to me, which indicates a level of distrust in Joseph's word. Because once Joseph says, I'll do as you have spoken, why does he have to say, swear to me? But again, the people who, and even some of the people who are the pro-Joseph faction, reflect on the fact that, you know, Joseph, first of all, not only that Joseph might not do this because Joseph is himself now naturalized to Egypt, but also because to take Jacob back to Israel might be seen by Joseph's boss as an insult. Is Egypt not good enough to bury your father, right? Pharaoh might say to Joseph, why don't you bury him here? And so it may be that Israel is hedging against Joseph's fear of Pharaoh's disapproval by saying, swear to me. Because remember what an oath is. When you make a promise, what you're essentially doing is binding yourself against your later wishes. If you didn't, you wouldn't make a promise, right? The promise presumes that later on you won't want to do what you promised, but since you promised, you have to do it. That's the whole idea. It's a weird thing in a way because it assumes that you are wiser now than you will be when the time of the promise comes to fruition. That's really what it assumes, which is a bizarre thing if you think about it, but that's what a promise means, or else it's a hedge against interests that you don't want to influence you at the time because you know that right now you're your highest self. So you'll say, I promise not to be upset with you if you tell me the truth, right? For example, to take a very common promise that's almost universally violated. So I promise, and that's, hold on to it just so that I can go through at least part of this. And so what Israel is asking Joseph to do is to make a promise that later on he knows he won't want to fulfill, otherwise there's no purpose in promising, right? That's really what a promise is. It's a hedge against later, which, by the way, we do a lot in life. It's the same thing that a penalty savings account is. Do this now because you know that later on you're going to want to take your money out, but you know you shouldn't take your money out, so penalize yourself in advance so you won't take your money out later. This, I remember, who was it? It wasn't Kahneman, who just wrote this book, the psychologist who won who along with Tversky did work that won the Nobel Prize in economics, the only psychologist ever to win a Nobel Prize in economics, and he just wrote a book about the delusions of popular thinking. But it was some economist who wrote about how his entire view of economics changed when he put out cashews for this meeting that he had in his house. I wish I remembered who it was, but I don't. And I don't think it's rattling around in there. I don't think it's going to come out. He said at a certain point, one of the people at the meeting said, take those cashews away. And he realized that the model that they were all working on, which is if you provide more goods, people will be happier, was an economic model, but it wasn't a human model. That sometimes people don't want goods to be presented to them for their own self-interest, even though they want them, they don't want to want them. So they would prefer that they not be there. And it's the same thing that sometimes when you go into a supermarket, it's good if they have two brands instead of 200, because sometimes 200 can drive you crazy and you would rather not have a choice than have a choice that's gonna just cause you anxiety. So that's why Jews have one Torah, as opposed to an Old Testament, a New Testament, a Book of Mormon, a Quran. We have much less anxiety than other people as a result. You may have noticed that in your experiences with other Jews. So a lot of anxious Mormons out there. Yeah, well, so in any case, the Israel exacts this promise because he doesn't think that Joseph later on is going to want to, and the best explanation of that is that Pharaoh will be insulted. But he can then say to Pharaoh, I promised my father, which is something that Pharaoh would presumably respect. He said, swear to me, and he swore to him. Then Israel bowed at the head of the bed. That is, it seems like he took his leave and also acknowledged the acknowledged both Joseph and presumably God. So, sometime afterwards, after these things happened, achar hadvarim ha'ela, after those things occurred, Joseph was told, your father is ill. So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Okay. Again, as we know and we've discussed in previous case, and will certainly prove to be the case when we finish off the book, there's something about a deathbed or a dying blessing that seems to have more potency than just a blessing when somebody's feeling fine. It's this transitional state, this twilight state between this world and the next, that gives people the sense that you draw some kind of power from the next world to bring into this world. You know, it's as if since you're on the way over, you're closer somehow to that world, and we see that world as the source of blessing more than this world. I think that's the psychology behind it. but also presumably there is there's a piety that attaches itself to the old, and the older the more pious. And so the maximum amount of piety that one accumulates is right before you die. So right before Israel is about to die, that's when Joseph brings his kids for their blessing. And also, I guess he doesn't want to bring his children for blessing before that, because that then presumes that you're about to die, right? So you want to wait. You know, you don't want to bring the rabbi in when the person is fine, because then they'll say, why are you bringing the rabbi in now? Obviously, I'm on my last legs. Either that or the synagogue needs a contribution. So I just want to keep it real. When Jacob was told, your son Joseph has come to see you, Israel summoned his strength and sat up in bed. So also, there's something very beautiful about this, which is that Israel understands his function in the family and in the world, and he pulls himself together for this act. Now, it's made less impressive by the fact that he's going to go on a long monologue in the next chapter, so he obviously had a lot of strength left to summon. But you know, well, people rally at the end sometimes in remarkable ways. But you do have this... You don't have this picture of an old man dying in bed, but he knows that this is the sum of what he's going to be remembered for by his grandchildren, which is true. Grandchildren will remember. I mean, we all remember final acts in some very powerful way, but grandchildren will remember that blessing in a way that's enduring. And so he summons his strength and he sits up in bed, which makes a nice contrast also to the way he left Joseph. How does he leave Joseph? By bowing at the foot of the bed. But now that his grandchildren are here, he's summoning himself and sits up in bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, El Shaddai appeared to me at Luz. Luz was renamed Beit El, if you may or may not remember. That's where he has the vision of the ladders. And also, remember that the ladders now, he's about to ascend himself. Then it was the angels. Now it's about to be Israel, who's going up the ladder, not to come down again. In the land of Canaan, and he blessed me. And he said to me, I will make you fertile and numerous, making of you a community of peoples. And I will assign this land to your offspring to come for an everlasting possession. Now your two sons, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, we'll come back to this in a second, shall be mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine no less than Reuven and Shimon. What does this mean in terms of Jewish history? There are two tribes. There's the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Manasseh. There is no tribe of Joseph, right? The tribes are Ephraim and Manasseh. So they're his. He's taking his grandchildren. In a way, they're more his than Joseph, because Joseph's not a tribe. because the truth is that Joseph lived his life and has his allegiance, as far as Jacob is concerned, to Egypt. That's the discreditable explanation, but we'll come back to that. But progeny born to you after them shall be yours. Anyone else, any other kids you have, you're welcome to them, right? But these two are mine because I didn't get to be there. They were born in Egypt, they grew up in Egypt, but I'm claiming them now. They shall be recorded instead of their brothers in their inheritance. I do this because when I was returning from Paddan, Rachel died to my sorrow when I was journeying in the land of Canaan, when still some distance short of Ephrat. I buried her there on the road to Ephrat, now Bethlehem. So they're her grandchildren. And I'm going to make her grandchildren, the ones that I live to see, I'm going to make her grandchildren my children, in her memory, basically. Okay? Now, why he does this, let's stop there and we'll and make several comments about this. First of all, why does Jacob do this? So there are, as always, as we've seen this again and again and again, there are two ways of looking at this story. One is as prophecy and the other is as explanation. By explanation, I mean, let's say at the time that this story was finally written down, there was a tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh and no tribe of Joseph, for whatever reason. So the story had to explain, why is it that there's a tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh and no tribe of Joseph? So then the story was written in such a way as to explain it, because that was the reality of the time. Okay? That's one possibility. In other words, the Bible is an explanation of what already was true. The other possibility is that, as I said, Jacob felt as though he could have a shaping influence on Ephraim and Manasseh in a way that he didn't feel he could have a shaping influence on Joseph, right? All of his children, Shimon, Levi, Reuven, Yisachar, all of them, even though they have their faults, they all grew up in under Jacob's influence, and they married under his influence, they had kids under his influence, and he was secure that their children would carry on the legacy, okay? That he knew. Joseph, he's not sure about. He doesn't know if Joseph's going to carry on the legacy. His best chance with Joseph is if he can insist that Joseph's children that will remember him as the deathbed patriarch who gave him this blessing, that they'll carry it on, because they're not shaped yet. Joseph is, but they're not. So he might have enough influence with Joseph to say, look, these are, remember your mother? I mean, to invoke Joseph's mother, his long dead mother, on his deathbed, that's about as many emotional strings as you could possibly pull. These two are the living products that your dying father gets to see of your long dead mother. So these two, I want you to promise, will carry on the legacy of Israel, even if, in parentheses, you don't, right? Because also it's going to be hard for Joseph to do that. He has other responsibilities at the moment. So you could understand why, even from a strategic point of view, it would make sense for Jacob to say, I'm going to take Ephraim and Manasseh, and Joseph, you live your life the way you want. I'm not going to put that pressure on you. I'm not going to insist that you become a tribe of Israel. I know that you're the viceroy to the Pharaoh, but your children have to be. So either way you look at it, whether it's, you know, post hoc or propter hoc, either way, whether it's after the fact or whether it caused the fact, it makes sense for Jacob to take this tack. And besides, that way he gets the 12 tribes. And as I said, when we get to the next chapter, which we should do before the coming of the Messiah, we'll talk about the tribes and how the tribes got I'm confident of that, actually, and how the tribes got arranged the way they did. But it also is, as far as we know, it's the only time that Jacob mentions his mother. And I just want to say, it says, and I in the coming of to Paddan Aram, it doesn't say to my sorrow in the Hebrew, right? To my sorrow is the English translation. I wonder if anybody has any other English translations of that verse. Does anyone else have another other than the JPS, or you all have the JPS? Yeah, you all do. But what it says in the Hebrews, what's that? What does it say?
I have the women's.
That's also the JPS, although they have some modifications.
They
yeah.
Don't have to my sorrow.
They don't have to my sorrow. That's more accurate. Because what it really says is, as I was coming to Padan, Meta alai Rachel, which means not Rachel died, but Rachel died on me or to me. So that's why they say to my sorrow, which is not a bad translation. I'm not saying that it's wrong, but I wanted to point out that the real, it's in some ways more poignant than to my sorrow, which is, it's like, when someone, you know, it's almost like if, when someone's dying or someone dies and the mate says, how could you do this to me? It was like she deprived me of herself in a way. So the phrasing in the Hebrew is more, I mean, it's hard to capture exactly how it is, because you wouldn't use that sort of coinage in English, but it's very it communicates to Joseph in one word what it is that he lost, that Jacob feels he lost in Joseph's mother, which also, by the way, we remember was the start of all the trouble, right? The fact that he loved Rachel more than he loved Leah. But that's already water under the bridge. This is the beginning of the deathbed scene of Jacob and Israel. And let me just, it's a whole other thing. So why don't we stop there, because the Ephraim and Manasseh blessing is a whole separate issue. And let me just make one or two comments, and then we'll take questions and comments from you, which is the Jacob story is the longest story in the book of Genesis by far. He gets more ink than Abraham. He gets more ink than Isaac. And because he's dying now, I just want to remind you of the part of the arc of his life is that Jacob started off, and I think probably recognizes himself in Joseph, as an ambitious and scheming young man who also was a dreamer. And Joseph is the same, right? Remember when we began the Joseph story, we read all those parallels from the Midrash between Jacob and Joseph, their experience with their brothers, that they looked alike according to the Midrash, that they were both dreamers, and on and on and on and on. They both had to flee home because of the wrath of brothers. I mean, there are a lot of parallels in their lives. This is just scratching the surface. But as he dies, Jacob is a very different sort of figure from the figure that he was as a young man. And unlike most biblical figures, not all, but unlike many biblical figures, I'll say, he undergoes a sort of radical transformation by virtue of his dreams and his encounter with his brother and his loss of Joseph. And there is a very famous essay famous, not like, you know, Oprah didn't have it on, but it was in biblical studies and literary studies by Eric Auerbach, who was a German literary critic, called Odysseus's Scar. And it's about the Akedah, it's about the binding of Isaac. But the larger point of the essay is that in Homer, there are actually two points of the essay. One is that there's much more detail in Greek myth than there is in the Bible. It's called Odysseus' Scar because Homer actually describes the scar of Odysseus, which is a level of detail that you never get in biblical narrative. We don't know what Abraham looked like. We don't know what, you know, we know Joseph was handsome, but that's all we know. We know Saul was tall, but that's all we know. It's very rare to get any kind of real description. And also he talks about the fact that in Greek myth, by and large, heroes don't transform the way they do in biblical myth. That there's a steady, there's an unfolding of characteristics that already exist in Greek myth, but in biblical myth, people actually change their character. And Jacob is a really good example of someone who changed his character. You can't imagine the young Jacob being the person who gives the blessing to Ephraim and Manasseh. By the way, if the sun's in your eyes, feel free to move. Don't feel stuck in the, right. This is not an interrogation. It's just a Torah class. But you see this change here, and it's very powerful. The young Jacob, you couldn't imagine him as an old patriarch blessing, you know, as an old feeble patriarch blessing his grandchildren, but he is here, and that's the degree of his change probably has something to do with why he's the one who goes from Jacob to Israel, right? you don't get that degree. I mean, Abraham changes too, Isaac changes too, but not to the extent that Jacob does. And so, you remember even Yaakov, his name means, you know, heel or deceptor, someone who deceives, depending on how you read it. And to go to Yisrael, somebody who struggles or struggles with God, is already a gigantic change in the way he's seen in the biblical text. Okay, so let me stop there and take questions or comments on. Don, you had something before. It's a what?
This is the end of deception. I'm making a promise and putting a period at the end of deception.
You mean Jacob is no longer deceiving?
Yes. Not looking at some Joseph side, but looking at some Jacob side.
Right. That this is the end of any deception. Because it certainly is true that deception has been a constant motif in Jacob's life. He as deceiver and he as deceived both. Right? Obviously, he deceives his father. Then he gets deceived not only by Laban, who switches wives on him, but gets deceived by his children, who bring Joseph's coat to him, saying that Joseph was killed by a wild animal. And now it's the end of deception, and he's going home. So all of that makes sense. And also, the motif, Jacob's life in some ways can be seen as a mini drama of, as can Abraham's and Isaac's in some ways, as a mini drama of Israel in general, and the promise. I mean, he dies in Egypt, but eventually he gets to go home, and the people of Israel the same, right? They die in Egypt, they both live and die in Egypt, but eventually they get to go home. Yeah.
In the explanation section of the
It just means that Jacob was, Jacob lived presumably in, because he was Joseph's son and he gets to meet with Pharaoh. So the Midrash says that he lived, you know, not like a king, but kingly in Egypt, that he was honored as the head of the house of Israel and as Joseph's father and so on. I mean, that sort of thing. Yeah.
When Jacob is extracting this promise from Joseph, he's talking about Joseph's mother, Rachel, dying. Wasn't Joseph there? I mean,
yeah, he's not giving him news. He's just saying, right, he's just explaining to him, this is why I'm doing this, because she died to my sorrow. But also, I mean, this is part of Auerbach's point in that essay, Odysseus' Scar, which is the Bible is extraordinarily cryptic in the way that it describes events. We don't know what other discussions Jacob and Joseph had. We don't know what discussions Abraham and Isaac had during the 3 days that they marched to Moriah. I mean, where Abraham is going to, it's in a world in which every bit of information is shared, and I don't only mean personally, but I just mean, look, there were how many votes cast in Iowa? 25,000 votes, maybe? 125,000? Okay, still, it's a negligible amount. And yet, hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of pundit hours have to be filled explaining what it means. They have to, right? It's not their fault. That's their job. That's what they do. Little bits of information are chewed over endlessly. The Bible is the exact opposite. That is crucial questions that we would like to know, the Bible says nothing about. Exchanges that would seem the most natural. If you were writing the story, you would. That's why the Midrash, that's why the rabbis fill in so much, because the Bible leaves them an incredible amount of room And this, I mean, I could give you endless examples of this, but this is a perfect example. Did Jacob and Joseph have no other dialogue in all the years that Jacob lived in Israel? Did they never talk about their mother? Did Joseph never ask, you know? Did Jacob never say, how come you didn't send people to find out if I was alive? Did, you know, all those questions, the Bible doesn't give us any answer to. And we have to try to figure out why, but here it doesn't seem as though he's giving him news, because obviously Joseph knew that his mother had died, but because she died when Benjamin, his brother, was born. But it does seem as though the Bible, the corollary to that is that the more information and analysis you get, the less significant any bit of it, right? Nobody can say, oh my God, you missed, I can't believe you missed so-and-so's take on the Iowa caucuses. Because, you know, I mean, between newspapers and television and radio and internet, it's been analyzed to death and no single take is crucial. But you could say this piece of information, because it's included, obviously means something, since so much is left out. Why does the Bible decide to include Jacob saying to Joseph, your mother died on me? Obviously, he's telling him something, right? So that's the advantage of being sparing, is that people pay attention to what you say. Yeah.
What is the origin of Friday night? The father blesses his sons.
That's for next time. That's actually what we come to next time, is the blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh, right after, right, next week. We're going to come to that, yeah.
It seems odd that the translation, English translation, is do me a favor, place your hand under my arm. It seems like, and the Hebrew is totally different.
Which,
It's 29. It's the middle of 29, and it's, Vayomer lo.
It says, im na matzatichem benecho, which means, please, if I've found favor in your eyes, simna, please place. So, please, I guess, is...
But do me a favor.
Do me a favor, yeah, it's a colloquialism. It's please. It is more dignified than that. The JPS translation, which is the easiest one to read, has been criticized on the grounds of being too informal. That's, when it's criticized, that's what it's criticized for. It doesn't have sufficient dignity. It sacrifices dignity for readability. No translation is perfect, but that's usually when people criticize the JPS, that's what they criticize it for. Robert Alter criticizes it, who did his own translation, criticizes it for that a lot. And Do Me a Favor is a good example of that. It feels too, you know, like, hey, do me a favor, you know. Swear to me, yeah. Mira? No, matzati chen beinecha just means if you like me, if I found favor in your eyes. It's not necessarily asking forgiveness. Although, what you're saying is true, given the background of the story, which is both. I guess since if there's fault on both sides, it's always the parent that must ask for forgiveness, not the child, right? Because the parent presumably is the more responsible party. I mean. In one way, you would say the child, because the child is the child, and the child's the one who has to make supplication. But really, in a grown-up world, the parent is supposed to take more responsibility than the child. So since Joseph never sent messengers back to say, hey, Dad, I'm alive, but Jacob is the one who sent him out to his brothers in the first place. So you could say that Jacob is afraid that Joseph bears him a grudge and is asking, you know, if you're not angry at me or if you forgive me, please promise to send me back to Israel. I certainly think that it's a possibility, although you don't, for whatever reason, and here again, the silence of the Bible is suggestive, you don't ever hear explicitly of any ill will between Jacob and Joseph. You do between Joseph and his brothers, but you don't between Jacob and Joseph, which is strange in a way, since there certainly is cause for it. The way in which you might intuit ill will, even though it's not explicit, is saying, why doesn't Joseph send word back to Jacob saying that he is still alive, and maybe it's because he feels like Jacob sent him, you know, to the wolves by sending him out to check on his brothers. Yeah. It's hard to know, unless, as I said, the most favorable explanation is he's doing Joseph this favor of being able to say to Pharaoh later, look, I would bury him in Egypt, but he made me swear. He's my father and he made me swear. So maybe he's doing him a favor. Maybe Jacob is being more foresighted than Joseph by asking for this oath. I don't know. You could read it either way. It depends on how you see the relationship between Jacob and Joseph, and the Bible gives you lots of latitude to skew it in whichever direction, you know, pleases you or appeals to you. Yeah. Right. Right, well, it requires effort it's both. It requires effort, but it requires effort because you won't want to make the effort when the time comes. If you promise to go on a diet, it's not just about effort. It's, even though I know I'll want that cookie in 2 hours, since I promise to go on a diet, I'm not going to eat it because I'm going to bind myself by my previous statement, right? Which is, yeah. And that's why we break promises, because we say to ourselves, well, it's still me, so if I said I could do this, I can, you know, or I can do it tomorrow, which is, yeah. Genitals are what?
Sacred.
Yes. But the sacred is, it's still sacred. It's sacred. It's sacred in any. It's something. Well, it's an insult to see your father naked, and it's sacred to swear by genitals because it's the source of life. So in both cases, that's true. I mean, the same thing that is sacred is always in some way inhibiting. Why can't you see God? Because God is the ultimate source of sanctity, and sacredness is power. And so you swear by power, which is the power to generate life. I mean, in some ways, it's the most powerful part of a human being is the part that can generate more life. So it's two sides of the same coin, in a certain sense. Yeah. We'll get to the tribes when he blesses the tribes, right? Because the tribes are a whole separate question and issue. But yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. there's discussion about why Jacob buries her on the road, and right, I'm glad you reminded me of this. The commentators say, in part, that this is what he's explaining to Joseph, why she was buried on the way. The rabbinic comment is the reason that Rachel is buried on the road is so that during the Babylonian exile, when they file by, she can, you know, comfort them. Rachel mevaka al baneha, it says in Jeremiah. Rachel weeps for her children. And that's where, by the way, that's where the name Ramah comes from, right? A voice is heard on Ramah. That's the only quote. When you see the Camp Ramah literature, they stop the quote there because it goes on to say in Jeremiah, a voice of lamentation and bitter weeping, which is not what you want to tell people who are going to send their kids to camp. So you just say a voice is heard on Ramah, dot, dot, dot. But having said that, that's right. There, several of the commentators talk about the fact that he's explaining to her that she died on the way and that they buried her on the way. Because you can imagine also in the ancient world, it's not easy to carry a dead body for any length of time in the heat where it's going to decompose. Yeah.
These are nomads.
Right, they're nomads.
They don't have a permanent residence.
Right. So they, I mean, Israel in theory is going to be their permanent residence, but obviously, so so he's telling her, which is also, I mean, it makes a beautiful symbolic circle in a way that Rachel is the, you know, is the compassionate mother who weeps for her children, especially because she does not get to be buried in Moorat HaMachpelah, right? She doesn't get to be buried in the tomb of the patriarchs because she dies on the way. So, and also she dies in childbirth, which was a common enough thing in the ancient world. Yeah.
Excuse me, when Jacob had that huge wrestling match?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It does say that therefore the children of Israel eat not the sinew of
right.
the thigh vein, which is the hollow of the thigh. So
right.
is that still, is that the sacred reference that we're talking about?
No, it's different. Actually, that's why, right, the Gid HaNasheh, that part of the thigh is declared unkosher because of that story. But I think that it's not unique in the ancient world to swear by putting your hands near someone's genitals. I don't think that that's only Jewish. I don't know, I'd have to look it up, but my guess is that you would find it in other, just because the symbolic power of genitals, I mean, that's got to be in every right. I mean, anybody watching the Tudors or whatever, it's got, you know. Jerry. Yes, there's no doubt about that, which is why also he gives the speech that he gives when Joseph comes in with the kids. You know, God promised me this land, and we're going to return to this land. The pressure that Israel is exerting to go back to Israel is the sort of backdrop of the entire, not only the episode, but the entire story, which is why, you see that it works when Joseph says, I want my coffin to be brought back to Israel too. Let me just ask if there's anyone who hasn't had, is your hand up or are you blocking the sun? Okay, yeah.
Why is it that age is treated throughout our patriarchs' lives, there's vagueness as to how old they are and you know, how old was Isaac when he came
right.
up and how old was Rachel and Rebecca when, you know, and yet at the end of their lives, it's very succinctly laid out 147 or 175. What's the reason? Why do we need to know that Jacob was 147? He lived a full life.
Right.
He was an old man.
It's said as a sort of tribute. That is, he lived this many years because he lived well. And the more years you live, the better you did, so to speak, until Moses comes along, and then 120 becomes the established standard. But all the patriarchs live extended lives, and the idea, I think, is exactly that. That there's something, and even today, why do we celebrate it when somebody lives 100 years? Why? There's something magical about the idea of a long-lived person to us, and there was in ancient times too. I think it's deeply rooted in us somehow, and there is also this, there's a mixed sense. There's a sense of enfeeblement with age, but there's also a sense of increasing wisdom with age. So if Jacob, you know, was 146 when he gave these blessings, it means more than if he was 75 when he gave these blessings, for whatever that's worth. So, Jennifer? I can't hear you. You got to talk louder.
Oh, chapter 48.
Yeah.
When Jacob was told your son Joseph has come to see you, Israel suffered in his strength.
Right.
Is that the Hebrew, is that an exact
Vayitchazek, and he strengthened himself. It's this, yes, he strengthened himself. Yes. Yes. Well, it may suggest that such visits were rare, that he summons his strength when he hears Joseph is coming. That's possible. Of course, Joseph is busy, but you know.
I just wonder why it wouldn't be that he summoned it rather than.
I don't know. Jacob has 13 kids and not one comes to visit him, you know. it's an old Jewish story. It didn't originate with Jacob. The sense is it's reflexive in Hebrew, the hitpael, which doesn't exist in English, but it is he strengthened himself. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. 1-2 and then we'll close.
Since Rachel was not buried in the cave of Machpelah, do we know of any of the other matriarchs being buried there?
Yeah.
Other than Sarah?
Yeah. So was Rebecca and Leah, all buried there. Yeah.
No, we don't live any 140.
No.
They did. Why is that?
Why did they live so long and we don't? I think actually it was the it was the organic fruits and vegetables that it was before pesticides. That was well. Look, you have two choices. I don't, by the way, believe that it was the way they counted.
No,
I mean, they knew a year like we know a year, and they described a year like we describe a year. They understood, I mean, already in ancient Babylonian times, the sun's rotation around the earth, more or less, I mean, in some ways. It wasn't unknown to them. Ancient calendars, you know, they weren't as accurate as ours, but they knew what a year was. And certainly, by the way, I remember thinking this already when I was a little kid, which is they would say on the one hand, well, 6 days really means, you know, millions and millions of years, but 147 years really only means 50 years. So you can't have it both ways, right? Either a day is many years or a year is only a few days. The answer is, okay, the traditional Jewish answer is they were the patriarchs, they had special merit, and so they lived long lives, whereas we're just, you know, ordinary schmendricks and don't. That's the traditional answer, is God granted them especially long life and different ones, different lives. The other answer is that in all mythological and such stories, people's great heroes tend to live very long lives, and that's considered, you know, a mark of distinction and of greatness to live such long lives. So whichever explanation you want to take, you can. I think also there's, in some ways, numbers are used in the Bible very symbolically. Like 40 is used a lot. And 40 means a long time. Does it necessarily mean exactly 40? No, not necessarily. So it may just be another way of saying Jacob lived a very long life without meaning literally 147 years, but it's not clear. Rachel was young. It doesn't say. I don't remember what the year was. Well, there are people. The Bible does not mince words about the fact that some people die very young. They do. But the question of age and chronology, the only other point is, and this is important in reading the Bible in general, I really believe, and this is, I mean, not everybody will agree with this, but I think that it's true, that our conception of fact in story and the Bible's conception of truth in story are not identical. That is, the life of Jacob is intended to teach certain truths. I don't think that the Bible was as concerned with the factual accuracy of the story as it was with the religious truth of the story. And those things aren't always the same. So it's tricky, but I think that that's the way most ancient stories work. If we ask them, did Jacob actually live 147 years? In some ways, we're asking a very modern question of a very ancient text, and a question that wasn't of particular interest to the authors of the text. But that's a whole nother question for another time. Okay, please rise.